Welcome back to Four Winds Fellowships and to episode number 14 in our series on apostolic monotheism. We are going through the Gospel of John in this segment, and we have covered pretty much from the beginning of John up through chapter 6. This time I would like to delve into chapter 8. There's a very important statement in chapter 8. Verse 58, where Jesus concludes that chapter by saying, "Before Abraham was, I am." Now that verse is frequently used by Trinitarians to claim that the Son always existed with the Father. But that's not what the passage actually says. It doesn't really say anything about whether the Son always existed or not. It merely indicates that the Son existed before Abraham, which is by no means all going back to all eternity. All right, so that's one point I want to make. Now, as we look at particularly verse 58, but really we're going to look at several verses in this entire chapter and kind of follow the train of thought that is being developed, the logical progression that's being developed in this chapter, which pretty much concludes with the statement in verse 58. Now, in order to understand verse 58 and understand really several statements in this chapter, we have to look at an important clause that appears in verse 58 and also appears a few other times in this chapter, and that is the I am statement. Now, many of you know that Trinitarians attempt to take the before Abraham was, I am statement in John 8:58 as a reference to the statement of God or the angel of the Lord in the burning bush when Moses says, you know, "Who am I to say sent me?" And the voice said to him, "I am has sent you." So this idea of I am being a reference to God, or sort of a technical term for Yahweh God, is often used by Trinitarians in this particular passage, so that they're putting in the mouth of Jesus the claim that he is in fact Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament. Now, the problem with that kind of a inference is that this I am statement appears many times in the Bible. It appears many, many times in the Greek Old Testament. It is ego eimi. You can see up here in the title. I am is ego eimi in Greek. And it appears many times in the Septuagint, and it appears many, many times in the New Testament as well. And it never means I am Yahweh. All right, it never means I am Yahweh. While a similar statement when God says I am in Exodus 3 could be taken as a title, the other statements throughout the rest of the Bible in their context clearly do not mean I am Yahweh. All right. Whether they're spoken by Jesus or anyone else. And that's another important point, is that this statement I am is frequently used by others besides God or besides Jesus Christ. It's used of others many times in the scriptures. All right, so it's not a unique title for God. All right, so what's important to understand is that I am, ego eimi, here. The word ego is the first person personal pronoun, singular personal pronoun, which in English is I. And then eimi is the stative verb, present tense, stative verb, or the verb of being. So by itself, without any kind of a predicate, it literally means I exist, I am, I exist. But the fact is, this word here, eimi, this verb, every time it's used in the Bible, it either has a, it's in a predicate nominative clause, and it has a predicate. A predicate is similar to what you would think of as a direct object of a verb, except this is a verb of being, and so the predicate, which would normally follow the verb, tells us something about the first person here that's claiming to be I. All right, tells us something about them. Now, in the vast majority of places where the I am predicate nominative clause appears in the Bible, the predicate is actually stated. All right, but there are some times when the predicate is not stated, and when it's not stated, those are the things that are in question, which we're going to look at. So let's just look briefly about regarding these, some of the statements of Jesus in particular, because we're going to focus on Jesus, regarding the predicate, when the predicate is actually stated. So let's look at this. All right, so Jesus says, I am, that is ego eimi, the bread of life. The bread of life is the predicate. He says, I am, ego eimi, the light of the world. Again, that the underlined part is the predicate. I am the one bearing witness of myself. I am from above. I am not of this world. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection of the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the true vine. Now, all of these, as you can see, are just out of the book of John. And of course, the other gospels have some similar statements as well. All right, so the point I want you to see is that in these I am statements, most of the time, the predicate is actually stated right there immediately following the verb. All right, now, where it becomes a matter of interpretation and where some people tend to take some liberties is when the predicate is not actually stated, but it's only implied. Now, in all of the places where the predicate is not actually stated, where someone just simply says, I am, without saying I am what, specifically, the predicate is implied by what is in question or is being challenged in the immediate context. Now, you can see this repeated many times in the Old Testament, where God actually uses this term, especially in the book of Isaiah, I am this or I am that. Most of the time, he tells us what the predicate is, and he's referring to himself as the one true God. But there are times when he doesn't actually state the predicate, but in the context, it's clear. He's talking about the fact that he's the one who created all things. He's the one who has given us his word, all these different things. He's the first and he is the last. All these things that Yahweh says about himself in the Old Testament, he uses either a name predicate or the predicate is clearly understood and implied in the immediate context. All right, that's the thing I want you to really, really understand, is that if there is no predicate named, if it just simply says I am in the Greek, then the predicate is to be inferred by whatever is in question or is being challenged in that immediate context. And it must come from that immediate context. It is wrong to grab a predicate or an implied predicate from a different context and then jam it into John 8:58 and say, no, look, Jesus was simply saying, I am the Messiah. That's completely wrong. What Jesus was saying, I am, is what was in question or being challenged in the immediate context. All right. So in all of these passages in John's gospel here, we have Jesus simply saying, I am, without stating the predicate, However, the predicate is clearly implied in either the verse or the couple of verses prior to the I am statement. All right, so we see this clearly in John chapter 4, verse 26. This is where Jesus was speaking to the woman at the well. And she says, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called the Christ. Jesus' response to her is, I am. I, the one speaking to you, I am. Ego eimi. He doesn't say, I am the Christ or I am the Messiah, but that's clearly what he meant because that is what was in question in the very previous verse, right? I know that Messiah is coming. We just don't know when. Jesus is saying, I'm here. I'm him. Okay? It's me. That's the point of that I am statement. All right, in John 6:20, we have another case of the I am, which is identified only three verses earlier in verse 17, that what the predicate is intended to be. All right. In John 8:24, Jesus says, I am. The predicate is identified in the previous verse. We see the same in John 8:28. Now we're going to go through and actually look at these, at least the ones in John chapter 8 specifically. Now I want to skip down because we're going to come back to these. In John 9 verse 8, there was the question of the man who was born blind, who was begging, and people were questioning, is this the same guy who now can see? Is this the guy who was blind? And he responds by simply saying, ego eimi, I am. Okay, I am what? I am who? The guy who was blind. Okay, again, the context identifies what the predicate was intended to be. All right. And so this is a universal rule that applies across the board, whether we're talking in the Greek Old Testament or throughout the New Testament. The predicate, if it's not stated, is implied by what is in question or challenged in the immediate context. And that is the rule, and that rule needs to be applied in all these questionable passages in John chapter 8. Now, when I say they're questionable passages, what I mean by that is that biblical Unitarians who deny pre-existence of the Messiah try to find creative ways to make these statements go away so that Jesus is not claiming to have pre-existed, all right, or I've come down from heaven or whatever. All right, so that's what we're examining to see if that's actually a valid explanation. Now, what I want to do here is let's kind of refresh our memory from the previous lesson where we were looking at John chapter 6. And in John 6, Jesus made a couple of statements. Actually, there were several statements about being the bread of life that has come down from heaven. But the important point is that Jesus didn't just use that as a metaphor, saying, you know, I'm the bread of life which comes from heaven. He uses the first person pronoun, I have descended out of the sky, or in some translations, I have come down from heaven. The first person singular pronoun requires personal existence at the time of the event described, which means he had to be an actual person who came down from heaven. All right. So he says, I have descended out of the sky, not so that I may do my own will, but the will of the one sending me. And then in verse 61, when the disciples are all bothered by Jesus' statements about eating his flesh and so forth, Jesus says, having observed in himself that his disciples are complaining about this, said to them, quote, is this offending you? What then if you should see the Son of Man ascending to where he was formerly or before? This statement, along with this statement, requires a personal, literal history of the Messiah in heaven and then coming down from heaven. All right. That's what it requires with any normal reading of the text. So now with that background, when we get up to John chapter 8, we're going to look at how these ideas progress in John 8. All right. So we're reading from the LGV, Last Generation Version. It's available on our website. If anyone wants to get it, I'll put a link below the video to that translation if you want to download it and use it. All right, so in verse 21, this is what it says. Then Jesus said to them again, I am leaving, and you will search for me, and you will die in your sins. Where I am going, you are powerless to come. Now, this is important because there are several times in John where Jesus leaving and where he's going are sort of contrasted with where he came from. Actually, not contrasted, but parallel, right? Parallel to where he came from. He frequently said that he came down from heaven and that the Father sent him. And then there are other places where he said, I'm going to the Father. I'm going away. I'm ascending to heaven, you know, things like that. And so we have these ideas sort of placed in comparison. We see this in John 3:13, where John writes, no one has ascended into heaven but the one who descended from heaven, right? So we see these ideas being contrasted as though they're opposites. In John 16, we also have Jesus saying sort of the same thing, that I'm going back to the one who sent me, and the disciples questioning, you know, where are you going, and so forth. And this language of coming from the Father and going back to the Father are contrasted in John 16. And then the disciples say that now you're speaking literally. You're not using figures of speech. And so the disciples were clearly understanding Jesus to be speaking literally. And when he says he came from the Father and he's going back to the Father, the implication is he came from heaven is going back to heaven. All right, because those two things are being contrasted because they're opposite things. All right, so we have that kind of language here in John chapter 8. It's also in John chapter 7, if you want to read John chapter 7. All right, so it says, then the Judeans said, will he kill himself since he says, where I am going, you are powerless to come. Obviously, that's heaven, right? And he said to them, now this is really important because we have two of these I am predicate nominative clauses, ego e mi, and in both of these clauses, the predicate is stated. All right, so let's look at these. You are from below. Now here we have it. I am, ego e mi, from above. From above is the predicate. All right. Then he says, you are from this world. I am, ego e mi, not of this world. That is the predicate. Not of this world is the predicate. Now notice in both of these I am, ego e mi statements, the predicate is named, right? However, look at verse 24. Therefore, I said to you that you will die in your sins, for unless you should believe that I am, ego e mi, there is no predicate named, you will die in your sins. So how are we to understand I am here without the predicate being named? Well, it's simply because the predicate is already implied in the context in the very previous verse. So when he says, unless you should believe that I am, he's saying, unless you should believe that I am this. That is what I just told you. Well, what did he just tell them? I am not of this world, and I am from above. So we could substitute these two predicates and put them here, and this is what the I am statement is affirming. All right, so let's read it that way. For unless you should believe that I am from above and not of this world, you will die in your sins. All right, I hope you can see that, how that the predicate for the I am statement is assumed by what is actually being stated or is in question, or perhaps his readers didn't really believe. So he's affirming. I am is an affirmation, but it's affirming what is being questioned or implied in the context. All right, I hope that makes sense to you, because that's going to be very important when we get down to verse 58. All right, now let's continue in verse 25. Then they said to him, "Who are you?" And Jesus said to them, now this is where, verse 25 is where almost all translations get it wrong. And they get it wrong in their translation because of Trinitarian bias. Trinitarians believe that Christ is co-equal and co-eternal with the Father. And if the Son is co-equal and co-eternal with the Father, then he always existed. And if he always existed, he cannot have a beginning. All right? That's really important. So the Greek actually reads exactly as I have it here, with Jesus answering their question. They ask him, they put it to him bluntly, "Who are you?" Jesus said to them, quote, "The beginning." That's exactly how it reads in the Greek text. "And that which I am saying to you," or it can be read, "and the one who is speaking to you." That is, who are you? The beginning. Who is also speaking to you, or that which I am saying to you. Either one can be read from the Greek text. Now, why is this important? And how is it wrongly translated in most translations? Well, what they do, what the translators do, is they rearrange the sentence so that they put the beginning at the end of the sentence instead of the beginning of the sentence where it actually is in the Greek text, and they add the pronoun from, so that it reads, "That which I am saying to you from the beginning." But that is wrong. It's wrong because if you have the preposition from in English, if that was being implied in the Greek, there is no preposition in the Greek here, but if it was being implied in the Greek, the preposition would have to be one of the, the beginning, the object of the implied preposition would have to be in the genitive case, because the prepositions that imply from, such as apa or ek, always take a genitive case object. So if this was implying the preposition from, then the beginning would have to be in the genitive case in Greek. It's not. It's in the accusative case. What is the accusative case? The accusative case is the case used for the direct object of a verb. All right. So what did Jesus mean when he said, when they asked him, "Who are you?" And Jesus said to them, "The beginning." Well, that is being drawn directly out of Proverbs chapter 8, verse 22, which in the Septuagint reads, "The Lord made me the beginning of his way for his works." And then it goes on to talk about being wisdom here, which is what's who is speaking, having been begotten by God in verse 25. All right, so wisdom is begotten by God, and wisdom describes this begetting out of God as being made the beginning. And what's really interesting is in the Septuagint, in that verse, in Proverbs 8:22, the beginning, the word beginning is in the accusative case exactly as Jesus quotes it here. All right, so it's spelled exactly the same way. All right. All right. So that's really important. Jesus is actually taking the title, the beginning, from Proverbs 8:22 from the Septuagint and saying, that is me. Wisdom. I am wisdom, the beginning. Now, you may remember also that the Apostle Paul in Colossians 1, I believe it's 18, when he's referring to Christ, says of him, he is the beginning, using the same language as a title. the beginning is a title for the Son of God. And then, of course, in Revelation chapter 3, verse 14, when Jesus is speaking to one of the seven churches, he calls himself the beginning of the creation of God. And that is a reference directly to Proverbs chapter 8 also, because Proverbs 8, what is it describing? It's describing the begetting of wisdom, and then wisdom becomes God's protege, as it were, in the creation of all things. The same things that are stated in John's prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were created through him. Without him, nothing was created or originated. All right, so we see that concept in Proverbs chapter 8, and here Jesus is taking the title, the beginning, from Proverbs chapter 8, which implies his origin. It implies that Christ is claiming to be wisdom in Proverbs 8, and in that statement, by being called the beginning, wisdom is indicated as the very first thing God produced before he created anything. And how did he produce wisdom? He produced wisdom out of his own being, because wisdom is said to be begotten by God in Proverbs chapter 8, verse 23 through 25. All right. It's stated twice, actually, in the Hebrew text, as far as being begotten, once in the Septuagint in those verses. All right, so let's continue reading. I have much to say and to judge concerning you, but the one having sent me is true. And that which I heard from him, these are the things I speak to the world. They did not know that he was speaking the Father to them. Then Jesus said to them, whenever you may exalt the Son of Man, then you will know that I am. Ego eimi. Again, there is no predicate named. So let's read the sentence. Whenever you may exalt the Son of Man, then you will know that I am, and I do nothing from myself. Now, what does he mean here? What is the predicate? The predicate's not named. Again, our rule is, if the predicate is not named, it is to be drawn from the immediate context. What goes immediately before? Well, what goes immediately before this I am statement? Right here. Who are you? Jesus said to them, the beginning, that is wisdom, the one in Proverbs 8 who was begotten out of God and who was God's, who was a master craftsman working beside God in the creation of all things. So Jesus is claiming to be the beginning. And then he says, whenever you may exalt the Son of Man, then you will know that I am. I am what? I am who? The beginning. Wisdom. In Proverbs 8. All right? So we see the predicate is right here. All right. Now let's look at verse 42. Jesus said to them, if God was your Father, you were loving me, or could be translated, you would love me. But literally, it's a imperfect tense verb. So literally, it says, if God was your Father, you were loving me. For, notice this, I issued forth out of God and am come. I issued forth out of God. That's literally what the Greek says. I issued forth out of God. He uses out of God here is ek theon. Excuse me, ek theou. Ek theou, because it would be in the genitive case. I issued forth out of God. Now, what does that mean? I issued forth out of God. Well, that kind of language is used of a being that is begotten of a father. And this is precisely what Proverbs 8 says about wisdom, who is called the beginning, there that wisdom is begotten. And so this is the begotten language from Proverbs 8 that is also implied by Jesus' statement up here when he claims to be the beginning, the one called wisdom in Proverbs chapter 8. All right, now let's go down to verse 56, and this is where this entire dialogue sort of comes to a conclusion, and Jesus' hearers are about to pick up stones and stone him to death because of his claims. So he says in verse 56, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he should see my day, and he saw it and rejoiced." Now the question is, if you know, these Jewish scholars are interrogating Jesus, and he says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he should see my day, and he saw it." Not that he should see it, but he did. He actually saw it, and he rejoiced when he saw it. Well, if you know the history in Genesis of Abraham, what we have is the story in Genesis chapter 18 of three persons approaching Abraham at his tent door. And one of these three persons refers to himself as Yahweh repeatedly, right? And of course, it's not the father who's appearing to Abraham, because no one has seen God at any time. John 1:18. It is the son who's appearing to Abraham in Genesis chapter 18. Also, the promise was given to Abraham in those chapters that Sarah would have a son. And the same person says to Abraham, "I will return to you," basically a year from now, "and Sarah is going to conceive and have a son, and you're going to call his name Isaac." All right, so the promise was given to Abraham that not only, I mean, he already had Ishmael, but Ishmael was not the child of promise. Abraham was promised a son through Sarah, his wife, and Abraham rejoiced at that promise. So there's no question that when Abraham rejoiced that he should see my day and he saw it, that is, it happened. He came back. The same person came back to Abraham a year later, and Sarah conceived and had a child, Isaac. He rejoiced that he should see it when the promise was made, and he saw it and rejoiced when the promise was fulfilled. That was the promise of Sarah becoming pregnant and Isaac, the child of promise, being born. All right. So this is what's being stated here. "Then the Judeans said to him, 'You have not yet reached 50 years, and you have seen Abraham?'" Okay, how do they understand this? These are Jewish scholars. All right. Now you're going to find biblical Unitarians are going to try to explain this passage away. And they're going to claim that Jesus was, that these Jews were totally confused, that they had no idea what Jesus was talking about, and they're going to try to import some language from the Talmud that talks about pre-existence of Messiah in name only, things like that, and try to make connections to those kinds of things. But if those ideas that Messiah pre-existed only in the plan of God, and his name existed, but he did not exist as a literal person, and that John is expecting his readers to, you know, sort of read this stuff through that kind of a lens, that was sort of a Jewish way of understanding the kind of pre-existence language that we find in the Gospel of John. This is what biblical Unitarians claim. Why then didn't the Jewish scholars, why weren't they aware of that? I mean, how is it that John expected his readers to view all this pre-existence language through a supposed Jewish way of thinking when Jesus is speaking to Jewish scholars and they didn't come to that conclusion at all? Why didn't they think of that? See, it doesn't make any sense, and biblical Unitarians can't have it both ways when they try to use that kind of argument to get around all the pre-existence language in John's gospel. But anyway, let's get back to these to these statements. Okay, so your father Abraham rejoiced that he should see my day, that is in anticipation of his day, and he saw it. So it occurred, it was fulfilled, and rejoiced. Abraham rejoiced when he saw it. He saw the fulfillment of the promise of the seed, which was Isaac. Then the Judeans said to him, and by the way, my day would imply Christ's presence with Abraham when the promise to Isaac was made, and when the promise to Abraham about Sarah having a son, Isaac, was made, and then, of course, when it was fulfilled, his presence would have to be there, according to this statement. Then the Judeans said to him, you have not yet reached 50 years, and you have seen Abraham? Now, again, notice Jesus' statement was that Abraham saw Christ's day, and he saw it, and he rejoiced. The Judeans took that to mean that Jesus had actually been with Abraham, and not only Abraham saw him, but he saw Abraham. All right, so this would require personal preexistence. There's no question about it. All right, a literal preexistence. Right, so these Jewish scholars to whom Jesus is talking took him to mean, from this statement and, of course, all the previous statements, personal and literal preexistence before his birth in Bethlehem, which is what they brought up, his birth in Bethlehem, right? 50 years old. It had only been, it's not even 50 years since he was born in Bethlehem. How is this possible? This is not possible in their thinking because they're presupposing that Jesus means a literal preexistence. So Jesus says to them, truly, truly, I tell you, before Abraham originated, I am. Ego eimi. Or I exist. I am this. What is this? Okay, what is the predicate that's implied? Well, the predicate that is implied is what is stated in verse 56 and verse 57. And what is that predicate? That the predicate is what is being assumed or is being challenged in the immediate context. Jesus is telling them, Abraham saw me and I saw Abraham. That, at least that's how they interpreted it. And Jesus is affirming it, that that is absolutely true by saying truly, truly. Affirmation. I tell you, before Abraham originated, I am. I am what? I am this. I am the one who Abraham rejoiced to see. He saw, he rejoiced, and I have seen Abraham. The premise of their question is that he and Abraham had seen one another face to face. And again, that's described in Genesis chapter 18 and other places as well in the book of Genesis where Abraham encounters the messenger of God in chapter 22 when he's offering up Isaac and the messenger of God calls to him out of heaven. All right. So we see Abraham encounters God's agent, and the I am statement here is affirming this. Now, what biblical Unitarians do is they take another statement. Let's go back up here. In John 4:26, where Jesus is talking to the woman at the well, and she says, I know that Messiah is coming. And when he comes, he'll tell us all things. And Jesus says to her, I am. Ego eimi. The implied predicate is the Messiah from the verse before it. What biblical Unitarians will do is take that predicate from John 4:26 and try to jam it into John 8:58 so that Jesus is saying, truly, truly, I tell you, before Abraham originated, I am the Messiah. I am the Messiah. And then not only just the Messiah, as opposed to I exist or I am this one, they'll say that he's only the Messiah in the plan of God and not in reality. The problem there again is that this pronoun, I, ego, in Greek, is the first person singular personal pronoun. Every time it occurs in the Bible, in this clause, I am, ego a me, every time it occurs in the entire Bible, and as many, many, many times, regardless of whether God is speaking of himself, someone else is talking about themselves, Jesus is talking about himself, the blind man, you know, man who was born blind is saying, I am the guy. Regardless of the context, whenever ego a me appears in the entire Bible, I, ego, first person, singular pronoun, always indicates a literal existence of that person at the time of the verb, which is ego, which means is present tense verb. All right. So if this means what biblical Unitarians claim it means, then this would be the only time in the entire Bible where the pronoun I does not require that the person actually existed at the time that's being referenced by the verb. It'd be the only time out of many, many, many occurrences. So you can see how far-fetched that explanation actually is. It doesn't make any sense. It's not valid. Jesus is here claiming to be the one who spoke face to face with Abraham, causing Abraham to rejoice. And he even extends his answer beyond what they were assuming, right? To assume that he spoke face to face with Abraham, that's part of their question and their assumptions. Excuse me. He's assuming that. But Jesus goes even beyond that to place his existence even before Abraham was born. So Abraham was 100 years old when this incident occurred with the promise of Isaac and Sarah having a child and all that kind of stuff. Abraham was 99, and then when it was fulfilled, he was 100 years old when Isaac was born. But Jesus is claiming a continuous existence from before Abraham originated, before Abraham himself was born. That is even placing himself even 100 years, at least 100 years before Abraham, before Isaac's birth. All right, that's what he's doing here. What he's not doing, let's talk about Trinitarianism, right? What he's not doing is saying, before Abraham originated, I am Yahweh. That is the name that we see in Exodus chapter 3, where God says to tell them that I am sent me to you. He says that to Moses. Jesus is not claiming that any more than when the man born blind, and they're saying, is this the guy who was born blind? And he says, ego a me. He's not claiming to be Yahweh from Exodus chapter 3, nor is he claiming to be the Messiah. All right? He's claiming to be what's in question in the context. And here, as I think I have shown conclusively, always these I am statements, whenever the predicate is not named, it's obvious in the verse or verses that immediately precede the claim. All right? It's obvious what is being affirmed in those places, right? So what do we learn from all of this that we've looked at in John chapter 8? What we've learned is that, number one, the Trinitarian interpretation of this passage is wrong. Jesus is not claiming to be Yahweh. However, the biblical Unitarian explanation is also wrong. Jesus does have an origin. He claims to have an origin when he refers to himself as the beginning, that is wisdom, from Proverbs chapter 8. He affirms that he has come down from heaven when he says, I am from above and I am not of this world. He affirms that, so he is clearly affirming his pre-existence, which we have seen in chapter 1, we've seen it in chapter 3, we've seen it in chapter 6, and now we're seeing it repeatedly in chapter 8 as well. All right, so he has an origin at the beginning of creation because he is wisdom. And he has come down from heaven, literally, and he is not from this world. And he is the one who issued forth out of God, indicating his begetting as wisdom. And then he is the one who made the promise to Abraham that Isaac, that Sarah would conceive Isaac, and that Isaac would be born at this set time next year, is what it says. And then he's the one who returned and Sarah conceived, and is the one who caused the miracle to occur in Sarah's womb, and she conceived. And so Abraham saw it and he rejoiced. Truly, truly, I tell you, before Abraham originated, I exist. That is, I am this one that he's claiming here. All right. The Jews were not stupid. They knew what he was saying. They knew what he was claiming. And that's why they picked up stones, so that they might cast them at him. But he slips away. All right. I hope you got something out of that. God bless. And we'll see you next time.